May be seated. This is the time set for rules hearing on a number of proposed amendments and adoption of new rules. And I'll just note for the record that the first four proposed amendments have been submitted by the State Bar Practice Rules Revision Committee. And I don't know, Mr. Burke, if you're going to speak on those in terms of just outlining a little bit of the background on those four different proposals. You don't have to, or is there somebody else that's going to speak on it?
No, it's me, Your Honor. I just didn't know if I should say that from way back here.
Yeah, why don't you come on up? And so the four proposed rules, the first proposed rule relates to the time for serving briefs. The second proposal relates to service and filing of pleadings and other papers. The third proposed amendment relates to the subpoena of witnesses and production of documents. And then the fourth is proposed changes to a number of the forms in the appendix to SDCL Chapter 15-6. So maybe you just want to go ahead and set out, you know, obviously we've got the explanation, but if you just want to kind of outline those four rules for the court.
Very briefly, thank you, Chief Justice, and good morning, Justices. It's my pleasure to be here this morning. I'm the chair of the Practice Rules Revision Committee for the State Bar, and the proposed amendments originated from that committee. They were then presented to the Bar Commissioners, which approved them back in April of this year, and then to the Bar at Large at the annual business meeting in June. With that background, I know that the court does have the benefit of them, and so I won't go into them in detail, but I would briefly touch upon them. Your Honors, as it concerns 15-1-26-33.2, really that's nothing more than I would call that a housekeeping matter because of the way that Odyssey and briefs are being filed. In terms of 15-6-5, that is probably the more substantive proposed amendment that comes before the court. And at its core, the objective was in day-to-day practice and just with the advent of Odyssey and now electronic filing rules, the effort was to get 15-6-5 at least a little bit more in line with what's actually going on and to make it more consistent with the advent of Odyssey and now service through Odyssey and service by email. That's the objective. Substantively, there was not a goal to fundamentally change the rule or how service could be accomplished. It was difficult to describe in the summary I put together in terms of what, you know, each little change, but that's the overarching objective. And I'm going to circle back to that rule in a second. A couple brief comments. Service by facsimile was discussed at length. There are some attorneys that don't care for that still existing. The decision was, though, that it should remain for a couple of reasons. We thought, especially if you're dealing with a pro se party, they may actually serve by fax or have that capability. And also, some attorneys are still doing it once in a while, and so it was left in there, just like it existed in the prior rule. I'm going to circle back with my final comments to this rule in terms of, I guess, changes. Like I said, most of it is fairly consistent with what it was before, and I think in large part is consistent with how they're doing it in the federal rules. The next rule is 15-6-45A. This also originated out of the committee, and I brought this up way back when, and it what the committee came to a consensus of was sort of a happy medium. As the court may know, the federal rule has a very detailed, basically it's the text that comes out of Rule 45 that is placed as an attachment to federal court subpoenas to advise witnesses or parties receiving subpoenas of their rights so they understand their obligations. Other states do something a little differently. I thought it would be a good idea, honestly, from both sides' perspective, for the attorney serving it and for the recipient of the subpoena, to have something, because I think those of us still in practice have had clients sometimes refer to a subpoena, well, I got this paper, and they may not approve. Even we try our best, and at the bottom it says issued in the name of the, you know, the Honorable Judge Blank of the Seventh Judicial Circuit. We're trying to get them for two reasons. It benefits everyone if the witness appreciates that he or she has obligations under it, but on the flip side, also that they have certain rights, because we've also run into the scenario where sometimes the opposite happens and a person will get a subpoena, and before the other side even knows or anything's happened, they don't even think that they can talk to a lawyer. I shouldn't say they don't think they can talk to a lawyer, but they may not even think about that and just hand stuff over. So the thought, after the committee went through it, this was sort of a happy medium, if I guess, is this new text that would be put at the bottom of a subpoena. And
was there some thought given to our discussion about using the more expansive rule that you included in your comment?
Yes. I'm not sure how to summarize that. I think there was a balance that I found among the members of the committee, at least, that there was a consensus that the person should be advised of their rights, but then it seemed that some members had the fear of, if we give them too much, is it a little overwhelming? Because I will tell you, the full text that they attached behind a federal subpoena probably is a bit daunting for the layperson, and it's not written very well for a layperson to read, just my opinion. And so I'm not sure that it's as helpful. But I think some members of the committee had a concern that you could almost spook the person into not wanting to comply. And my personal thought, and why I was okay moving away from just quoting the text like the federal rule, is I don't know that it's that helpful to the user to load them down with that text. But it was discussed. The final proposed amendment really had to do with some forms, and that was more in the nature of housekeeping as well. Some of the forms were fairly dated. And in all candor to the court, I think there are a number of additional forms that the bar could come up with if they were so inclined. But that was not the objective with this run. Probably the biggest, what I'll call fundamental change, is, and there were some duplications and things like that, but the more fundamental change that I think will be helpful is we modified the form if there's going to be a motion to compel. And we kind of cleaned that up. But then separately, we gave the user or the practitioner an example of a certification of the good faith effort that they need to be making before they're filing a motion to compel. I know that some attorneys will just do nothing more than a sentence. Some people do an affidavit. But the goal here was that we would give the practitioner kind of a guide. Hey, before you file this motion to compel, here's how you might want to lay out your good faith effort. So as I said, I was going to circle back to 15.6.5, and so I was only going to add absent questions from any members of the court about those proposed amendments. I kind of wanted to, I guess, take off my chair of the PR committee hat and just comment very briefly on the separate letter that I wrote for the court.
Can I ask a question there, Mr. Burke?
You bet.
Did you have any, so on the Rule 45,
yes.
Would you, so this is an extremely fine point, but in that bolded text, that would be part of the amended portion of the rule, where it says that, for that second to last sentence, where you have certain obligations and rights as it concerns this document, and then it references SCCL 15.645, which I know is, you know, the way it's kind of organized in our code book. That's just sort of the overarching heading for the entire rule. Would it make any sense, or did the committee want it this way? But would it make any sense to say, I think it's C and D, I think E's been superseded, and then I think there's two more after that, but reference the subsections that are broken out there, because if the idea is to direct the layperson to Rule 45, that might be unsatisfying if they get to Rule 45 and it just says subpoenas and there's no text. You know, you have to go through the subsections.
There was not a discussion. In other words, a person could maybe put 15-6-45A through E. I don't think that's a bad idea. I will tell the court, just to give you an idea of how we analyzed it, one draft of this rule actually had, an early draft had a link to where you could type in an HTTPS www website to go to, I assume it's the Legislative Research Council that maintains it, but basically take you to the statute. There was some concern about what if that changes down the road, and no, but I don't think that that would I don't think that that would be a bad idea at all. Our goal was to get them to the statute
to the
where
rule,
they can
right,
find
yeah.
it out. Yeah.
Gotcha.
Mr. Burke, have you seen the response that Second Circuit Judge Sandra Hansen put in? Do you have any issue with or concerns with that suggested change of adding some language that subject to court can modify that rule for service on underrepresented?
No, I don't think that's a bad idea. And I will tell you, in reality, that's something we've ran into in our office within the last year. And I did note, I don't have it off the top of my head, but I want to say that subparts 1 and 2 do have language unless otherwise ordered by the court in front of them. I think that's a sound suggestion, because obviously if you're looking for a different path, and we've had to leave envelopes at the clerk of court's office, you know, because it was not because the person wasn't able to be located. They didn't want to be located, and we, you know, we couldn't get an address or something like that. I don't think that's a bad idea at all, because then if one of these doesn't work, it would give the practitioner the ability to go to the court and say, okay, I'm trying to serve this person, but this, and this doesn't work. I think that's a good idea.
Any other questions for Mr. Burke on the committee proposals?
No, I'd just like to thank you for the work that your committee does and for your attention and your proposals.
Well, I appreciate it very much, Your Honor.
So you can take that hat off and put your hat on now.
A couple minor comments, and I'm going to confess to you, and I've spoken about this to Jeff Hurd, who's also been very helpful on the committee with me. Subpart B3B, and the original draft just had service by email, I think to the membership directory. And I think it was Ann Mines Bailey on our committee with the AG's office brought up at one of the committee meetings, and I did not know this because I don't typically have the Attorney General's office on the other side, pointed out that there must be like a common mailbox where they want briefing to go to. It may not be Ann Mines Bailey at state that whatever. I did not know that. And so the discussion that she brought up was, I don't know if it should just be what's in the bar directory. Everybody thought that made perfect sense, and so B3B was drafted. And I don't think it was the intent when it was drafted to maybe at least come off the way it's funny how you read things later on, and then you let them ruminate, and then you maybe read them a little bit differently. The concern that I had as an individual was not that I definitely want electronic service by email. That's fine. I had some concern about basically flip-flopping what should be the default, if you will. I thought it made more sense, now that I read the rule, that it would make more sense to have the bar directory listing be the default, so that the practitioner would have something reliable that they could sort of go to. And then only if the opposing counsel came to you and said, okay, in this case, I'm hereby writing you in a letter and telling you, for this case, you need to serve this. I thought that that provided some measure of consistency for the practitioner. And I also thought that the designation, just simply saying, unless designated in writing, you know, I didn't know if that meant if it was on their website or on their letterhead. So the way that I reworded it in my letter of October 20, was I make it a little tighter and say, unless the attorney upon whom service is to be made has instructed the serving attorney in writing. So that should leave no room for doubt as to whether you should have seen it on our website or on our letterhead. I'm saying that the default will be the directory, and I also thought that if everybody knows that, they can also use it, but it should also help reinforce practitioners to keep the membership, keep the bar up to date on their information, because that's going to be assumed where their emails go. And I say that again as an individual, just having thought more about the rule, and I wanted to offer it to the court.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yeah. Yes, Your Honor.
I sure understand where you're coming from, and I've got your understand your thoughts. And maybe it's it is the best way to do it. The membership directory is an annual publication, but of course people change from time to time. Employers or firms or whatnot, and that can change. So is the reference to the membership directory the annual one, or if they happen to move during the course of the year, that might be an instance where the lawyer would designate in writing that they want to have service at the new office?
That's a very good question, Justice. I pictured in my mind the printed one because I keep that in my desk, but I believe it's also on the State Bar Hub website as well. If someone moved, I would hope that when they transition perhaps to a different firm, whether it be in their changing their entry of appearance or sending something to opposing counsel, hey, you know, I'm at a different office now.
And that might cover it. And so that second provision that you've allowed for, you know, might cover it until the membership directory is published on an annual basis. I suspect, Mr. Fergal's here, I suspect that the membership directory maybe is a work in progress. It's just not published, you know, but for the annual publication. But probably at any given point in time, it's current perhaps to the notices that have been received up until that point. But I suppose that's right. I suppose if you move during the year and the membership directory address wasn't the correct default anymore, you have to have some faith that the lawyer wants to, you know, remain engaged with their cases, so they'll designate in writing, hey, here's my new email address.
And one would think, and I don't know how some firms handle it, but I would think, for example, that if I changed firms, something would have been done with my old email address, that it would have come back rejected or undeliverable to the sender, which should have keyed them off on a problem, ideally. But I also know that sometimes those are left on for a while people transition.
Can I ask you, Mr. Burke? I was practicing law before we had Odyssey. So we relied on the U.S. Postal Service when I was still practicing. We did have email, but we just didn't use it for service. So you've got 3A, which is electronically through the Odyssey system. Would you say that most service is done through that? Obviously, file and serve whenever you file something, but, I mean, is it frequent that you're using the B subsection in your experience in practice today?
It is. That's a really good question, and we've had this debate as well. And so when you go on Odyssey, and I don't claim to be an expert on it, but you can file and serve, and so when you file, the other side's going to get it, or you can just serve through Odyssey. I'm seeing that more frequently. There's still a lot of service by email, but it's typically discovery things. I often see notices of deposition, responses to interrogatories, requests for production will be attached to an email. I think the large or the primary reason that that's going on is if you are going to serve some responses to requests for production and it had a large attachment, I think that the users maybe find it easier to just send an email and attach it as a PDF as opposed to go through the Odyssey system. It is getting gradually more and more service directly through Odyssey, and I think the reason those that are doing it like it is they have sort of a neutral way of verifying that this actually was done. You know, they don't have to worry about whether the email address was right. But I would still say a large portion of service is still going what I'll call user-to-user email.
So my second question is, so under your your proposal, and I get it. I think there's some real merit to what you're suggesting, but you know, so let's say you're serving discovery on opposing counsel, send interrogatory's request for production. I assume you probably put your email on it. Most people now put their emails on their signature when you sign your signature line. I'm thinking, and maybe I'm not thinking right, but are people going to be looking at that email address that you've served them to serve it back, or are they going to go to the membership directory if that's different and look at that? Maybe if the rule tells them that's what they have to do, maybe that's what they'll do. But
that's fair. I will tell you, and I don't think I'm in the minority on this, I think most people, because of the case and already communicating, I don't often go to the bar directory to find people's email addresses because I'm typically already communicating with them or I've gone to their website or something. They would probably use the one that they were served on or that it came from, Your Honor. I think that's accurate. It'll be in the signature block, and then they're responding to an email. And that honestly touches upon one distinction between the federal rule and this rule. Is the federal rule as written, and I think it's coming, is I think the other electronic means of service, which would be fax and emails, I understand it, in the federal counterpart, you need to either have the other side consent in writing first or have served you maybe that way, served you in similar fashion for it to be a valid way to serve them by email, I believe. And I think I quoted that in the how it comports with the federal rule discussion. In other words, I think the federal rule still has, for direct email service, you would need them to consent or agree to service in that manner beforehand, which this rule wouldn't have.
Were you finished?
Yes. Go ahead. Yeah.
Some question about the terminology that you chose for your alternative proposal.
Okay.
Here, and so the original proposal referred to using the email address designated by the attorney or law firm. And I'm sorry, maybe you addressed this, and if you did, I'm afraid I missed it. But by the attorney or law firm for service. The newly proposed one just refers to unless the attorney upon whom service is made is instructed. And I wondered why the removal of the law firm. And I was thinking of, I hadn't thought about this, but you mentioned, I think you said Ann Mines Bailey from the Attorney General's office referred to, and you know, they may, for various reasons and the type of cases that come in, and I'm thinking of criminal cases or appeals in particular, where there might be some really time-sensitive things that need a response immediately that go to one central Attorney General's office address, email address. And I think that they may do that for tracking purposes also. But there's that scenario. And then, you know, there may be similar scenarios in law firms, I would assume, maybe that want to have notice coming in to the firm if there's something time sensitive that may or may not. And that's, you can, you know, designate an email, so that's not a problem here. But I'm just wondering why it didn't refer to the attorney or the firm or attorney or the, you know, other organization that the attorney is affiliated.
No, thank you. I will tell you, I actually did dwell on it, which those that know me would not be surprised by that. Here was my thought process. For example, when it said, I thought, first of all, by putting it on the attorney, we have a person that we will look to. And again, we're looking for, I hope, an obscure scenario here where someone claims to have served something by email and the other lawyer says, I never got it. And that does not happen, at least in my experience. That's an anomaly. So in other words, we're trialing.
It does happen in front of the court from time to time. Not necessarily this court, but the circuit court certainly.
Okay.
It does happen.
So here was my thought. If that happened, the judge, I assume if it came before the judge and something got missed or was not timely done, there would be a person that would have been responsible to have instructed that attorney where to serve. I had some concern that saying designated by the attorney or the law firm, you know, I'm not sure who that may be, or does that include, you know, their letterhead or things like that. I thought it put it on a person. In other words, he or she that entered an appearance in the case and they want service somewhere else, we know who is going to need to answer it. And then I had a little concern that law firm, I mean, obviously that the AG's office doesn't really fit in there either. And so I thought instead of saying an attorney, the law firm, state agency, you know, all those things, I thought it was better to be more specific and just say the attorney that's going to be served. You know, if I'm in a case and I'm expecting to be served, I mean, I have my address. Everybody knows that. But if I want to be served somewhere else to maybe a firm-wide email or attorney general's office-wide email, we know who it's on, if you will, to instruct that serving attorney.
Of course, if there's a if it's an initial filing of some sort, there may not even be an attorney assigned yet.
That's true.
That's the other scenario I was contemplating. And that would be more, you know, likely in the public sector scenarios.
That's I had not thought of, the initial filing where there isn't an appearance yet, perhaps. And what I don't know off the top of my head is whether what the requirements for are for that initial filing in terms of how it may be served or who it may have to go to. I would hope if it was a filing, an initial filing of some sort, there must be someone in the Odyssey that should get it that way, because I think that subpart B, again, to be doing it under subpart B, you're presumably thinking about things you're going to serve that are not filed, because if it's going to have to be filed, it'll be picked up through Odyssey and the AG's office or whoever should definitely get it that way.
The other scenario that I contemplated here, and this is a change that you made that refers to unless the attorney has instructed the serving attorney to use a different email address. Okay, so what about pro se litigants? So we may, the original version doesn't refer to that, like who you have to...
There
would be a number of, and I think pro se litigants, if they have an email, we have regular scenarios where I think they tend to, right or wrong, try to send things by email. So that was just another thought that I had, that maybe some language tweaking would be needed.
It may be better to, Your Honor, very good point, it may be better to say the serving party to pick that up, because
an attorney.
Yeah, because if we're in subpart B, we're serving upon attorneys, but that's maybe serving party. Your Honor, that's a... And serving party might be more prudent to address that scenario, Your Honor. The only other comments I would throw out there, because I don't know if there is a comparison, if you will, of the old rule, the new one, to go sort of line by line to see if everything was covered. The only other thing that I was aware of, that I'll make the court aware of, is the original 1565 had a separate sentence that dealt with faxes and emails, I believe, that basically said when you sign a fax, that's also your signature under 15611, or an electronic signature is also a signature under 15611. Those two sentences aren't re-quoted in the proposal. I don't think it was an intent to not have it be subject to Rule 11. I think it was more that it made sense that if I sign my name on a piece of paper and fax it to you, that's still my signature that makes me subject to Rule 11. In other words, I don't know that it added much, but that's for the court's edification, I guess.
Other questions for Mr. Burke? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Is there anyone that has wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to proposals 1 through 4? I don't see any... So then we've got the last two rule proposals, amendment and then adoption of a new rule from the State Court Administrator's office that consists of a proposed amendment to SDCL 15-12-37 on disqualification on the court's own motion, and then a proposal for adoption of a new rule concerning court reporter transcript fees. Mr. Satterzahn, do you want to speak to those?
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. On Rule Proposal 5, really just as a statement into the record, this is a corrective change meant to clear up an errant statutory citation. No substantive change at all there, so I just wanted to provide that explanation. If I may speak to Rule Proposal 6, this one's more substantive. This, just by way of explanation, traditionally the court reporter page rate had been set by the legislature, so they had essentially occupied the field in that area. During the last legislative session, supported by the Court Reporters Association and our UJS Court Reporter Committee, we went before the legislature and asked that that provision be repealed and allow the court to speak to this. Part of the reason for that is legislatively, that rate had not been changed since the early 2000s, and so it had become very stale. But there was really a hesitancy to go to the legislature and have a conversation about this topic, because I think, just to be very frank, it's an area that the court has more expertise in than the legislature. And so it allows the court to set page rates that I think fit in with what we're doing as a system around court reporters, because that page rate is something that goes directly to the court reporter as part of their compensation. And so this does allow, I think, the court to set that. In my mind, that coincides directly with our ability to recruit and retain court reporters and to ensure that we are competitive. And so that is some of the rationale behind it. So what the legislature did was approve the repeal of the provision around the page rate and the copy rate, but allowed this court the opportunity to adopt a rate and really take control over this area by adopting a rule that become effective on January 1. So this rule proposal is intended to implement that. Specific to the rule proposal, it would increase the rate to $3.60 a page, and then 65 cents a page for the copies. When you look at what that currently is, that would be an increase 65 cents on the previous $3 page, and then it was previously 40 cents a page for the other copies. And so it really, I think, in my mind, fits with the idea of how we recruit, retain court reporters. This is a small piece, but I think it's an important piece. I would just note for the record that court recorders, which our system does use more and more frequently, their page rate is determined by a Supreme Court policy, and so this makes the two things reflective. So I think there's a lot of sense in that. And you'll note that Appendix A has a breakdown of our surrounding states and what their rate is. The current proposal and the proposed rates were created by our Court Reporter Committee and endorsed as well, and I believe we'll have someone speak to that by the Court Reporter Association. So I just wanted to provide that as background, and I'm certainly happy to answer any questions.
Any questions for on either rule? Okay, thank you. Does anyone wish to speak as to either proposal, either in favor or against?
Good morning, Chief Justice and Honorable Justices. My name is Jenna Severin. I am an attorney here in Pierre, but I'm here today on behalf of the Court Reporters Association. We certainly appreciate and thank the Unified Judicial System for presenting on this rule change today. We believe that the court is the appropriate governing body to decide these changes as opposed to the legislature. And the court reporters are in support of everything that the Unified Judicial System has presented before you today. And we stand here in support of it as well, and we ask for your favorable consideration. Thank you.
Any questions from this center? Okay, thank you.
Good morning, Chief Justice Jensen and members of the court. I'm just here to say me too. I did want the court to know that the Bar Commission considered the proposed rule to increase transcript page rates for court reporters. I will say that our commission spent very little time on this. They understand the need to recruit and retain good court reporters, and a motion was made. It was seconded, and it was unanimously passed to support adoption of this change. So I'll stand by for questions if there are any, but the commission fully supports this proposed rule change.
Does the court have any questions? All right, thank you, Mr. Furman. Is there anyone else that wishes to speak either in favor or in opposition to proposals 5 and 6? Okay, not hearing anything, that will conclude the rules hearing, and we will take the rules under advisement. Thank you. Court is in recess.